They sold it as organic, but it wasn't organic at all. And they sold it as clean, but it wasn't clean at all. And so we ask, how can we force those who sell food to sell the food they promised to sell us?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1203rd edition of the Food Chain Radio, or hey, perhaps you're among a friend over there in Larnaca who are tuned in to the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, we begin with Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. Let's say by way of example that we buy some tomatoes from our neighbor, the McCoys, whom we know to be good people and very capable farmers. Being so close to the McCoys gives us the ability to look in their eyes and see what's in the tomatoes. Being close gives us control. But what if we buy some organic peas that were farmed in China? We have no idea who farmed the peas, and the farmer who did farm the peas has no idea who we are, and therefore has very little incentive to grow the peas with a great deal of care that we so demand. By being so far from the source of those peas, we have very little control over what's in those peas. Now, recently, we learned of the largest fraud in the history of American organic agriculture and the suicide of its lead perpetrator, Randy Constant, who sold up to 7% of the nation's organic corn, 8% of its organic soybeans to animal feedlots. Turns out that Constant's organic corn and soybeans were not organic at all, and therefore neither were the organic meats for which we paid all that extra money. Now we learn that the Panera Bread chain, which claims that 100% of its food is 100% clean, may actually be selling dirty food. A report published by GMO Free USA titled Eating Out, A Date with Glyphosate, claims that of the 15 restaurant chains tested, the highest levels of the weed killer glyphosate were found in the food samples purchased at Panera Bread. Having spent so much money buying organic food and food touted as being clean and natural, we simply must ask, how can we force those who sell food to sell the food they promise? And so today we head off to New York, New York, to talk to a man who has a plan. He is Kim Richman. He was the lead attorney and probably the proprietor of the Richman Law Group in Manhattan. Welcome, Kim. Happy to have you on the Food Chain
Radio Show.
Yeah, so you have a you have a boutique law firm. What is a boutique law firm? I've often thought it must be in a boutique someplace.
Yes, well, the Richman Law Group has offices here in New York as well as in D.C. and in San Francisco. And we like to emphasize the group and the Richman Law Group, as we do indeed operate as a legal collective of sorts. And we are a tight cadre of professionals ripping it up there, trying to keep our food systems clean and unadulterated.
Mm-hmm. And you do that by challenging those who are not. Correct?
That's correct. And we use basic truth in advertising as our legal theory. That if a company purports to be natural, pure, clean, for instance, they better well be natural, pure, and clean, according to a reasonable consumer.
So as you're riding across the legal landscape on your horses and leading the charge, your flag reads truth in advertising, right?
That's correct. And we have historically brought consumer protection class action suits, trying to address trans fat in our food systems, to GMOs, to now all things pesticides, namely glyphosate. And we have also been bringing these actions on behalf of nonprofits, on behalf of consumer watchdog groups, mm-hmm. and what we refer to as consumer watchdog actions.
Well, good. Let's start with the class action lawsuit, because we see on television quite a bit these days, especially with respect to glyphosate, how law firms are bringing these lawsuits against Monsanto Bayer for cancer-related charges with respect to glyphosate. Is that what you do?
Not exactly. You know, with regards to these consumer protection class action suits regarding food products, it's often economic injury that we're focused upon, not personal injury. However, we're hoping that using these consumer protection class action suits in these creative ways that we can get out in front of the issues before, say, the government eventually comes around or the science ultimately catches up to deem it to be indeed, in this case, carcinogenic.
Mm-hmm. And you work with consumer-related nonprofit organizations like Organic Consumers Association, Beyond Pesticides, GMO-Free USA. They come to you and say, we have some science that we'd like to discuss, and you work with them that way, right?
Indeed, and they are the canaries in the mine and often have their ear pressed firmly against the ground and are tracking these issues and have done so over the last number of decades. And they have often endeavored to perhaps legislate. However, in this environment, they have found that litigating is sometimes more effective in terms of shaping policy. And so we have a whole growing number of nonprofits that have indeed taken to the courts. I have always been of the mind that what you can achieve by way of legislation, you can achieve by way of litigation. In terms of making policy, ideally, the two go hand in hand. However, as of late, many nonprofits have been taking it to the courts.
Probably a little bit easier, you know. You probably, when the lawyers come walking in the door, the companies go, maybe it would be easier just to work this out.
Perhaps, and you know, many of these nonprofits have waged very interesting campaigns, social media campaigns, you name it, and it's just part and parcel to a multifaceted advocacy approach to layer in this legal campaign. And it is direct action against the industry, and of course, the subtext is to ideally shape policy within the food systems here.
Mm-hmm. And one of the phrases in your missive to me caught my attention. It said, to circumvent federal and state preemption issues. What did you mean by that?
Well, there are often preemption issues when it comes to certain forms of litigation, and it can range from, you know, fiercely preempted issues, like, for instance, a natural claim on meat packaging, which the FSIS, part of the USDA, has in fact defined and put a stamp of approval on, and that makes it tricky to go after the label itself. Or you have indeed organic integrity issues, and when you have that USDA organic seal on the packaging, it can also prove to be tricky. But we have nevertheless been successful in navigating, by and large, many of these preemption issues, and have addressed other forms of marketing and advertising that go beyond the label. Many of the nonprofits have been doing this vis-a-vis their consumer watchdog actions, wherein they go well beyond the label, which is typically the case with these consumer protection class action suits, wherein the consumer typically needs to have relied upon the statement on the label. And so that's a quick and dirty preemption analysis for you. But it is indeed a cat and mouse game.
Well, you know, consumers are certainly getting something from your efforts because you're enforcing some discipline on those who would otherwise may not have a lot of discipline. But what's in it for you and your fellow attorneys?
Well, we happen to be true believers, for better or for worse, and so we are dedicated, of course, to public health. And so over the years, as I mentioned, we were successful in addressing trans fat in our food systems well before New York or L.A. outlawed it from any restaurant, a decade before the FDA finally deemed it to be unsafe for human consumption. And so you know, we feel that we play a necessary role as a private attorney general of sorts in policing these contaminants within our food systems. And we've seen this also in the GMO context. And so we brought one of the early cases against Conagra, Western Oil. In its wake, there were dozens, if not 100 or so, GMO cases. And I think that that forced the market to have better disclosure and was more successful in changing perhaps more labels within the marketplace than any state initiative ever had the chance to do so. Then we, of course, then saw preemption with the DARC Act, with the national legislation when it came to GMO labeling. And that quashed, I think, a lot of efforts to have true transparency in the marketplace. But we've found this to be a very effective way of protecting, yes, our children, our ourselves, mm-hmm. our families, in terms of getting out front and center on behalf of our clients here.
On behalf of those who do not know what the DARC Act was, could you give a quick thumbnail?
So this was on the heels of the Vermont legislation around GMO labeling, which was to be effective legislation in bringing true transparency, truth in labeling around products that contain GMOs.
So if you have,
national legislation.
Yeah, if you have GMOs, you have to label it. That was the Vermont legislation, correct?
That's correct. That's right. And so we saw a lot of these efforts across the country, and it was just the consumer's right to know. And California to Vermont basically wanted to give consumers the right to choose. And unfortunately, the DARC Act, which was really, I think, driven a lot by industry and not by consumer interests, is now rolling out. And instead of saying product contains GMOs, it would have something to the effect of it being biologically engineered, a term that perhaps consumers don't immediately equate with GMOs. Mm-hmm. And so it also draws a line in terms of what products do and do not have to necessarily disclose itself as biologically engineered.
So in essence, industry did not want to have to label all of these things. It was much too much work for them. And also it gave consumers maybe a little bit too much information as to what they may or may not want. And if they don't know what's in it, then you're much better off. And you come and say, no, that's not the way we want to play this game. If you say something is natural, if you say it's clean, then it better be natural and clean. If you say it's organic, it better be so. Sometimes it is not. When we come back, we're going to pick up a couple of situations that are really big. One of them is the Panera Bread situation, in which here's a company that promises that 100% of its food is 100% clean, but it's not. And there's the huge issue of Brandy Constant and his giant organic food fraud. And how are we going to force these people to sell us what they say they are going to sell us instead of what they're really selling us? This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. Today we have Kim Richman, who is an attorney with Richman Law Group. We're talking about how to get people, the companies, to sell us what they say they're going to sell us. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, a little bit more of What's Eating What. You know, the National Restaurant Association did a survey of 700 chefs around the country. What's cooking was the question. And the top 10 concept trends, one of the top ones, top three as a matter of fact, was that consumers want clean food, which is to say food without bad stuff in it. And so Panera Bread cleverly picked up on that trend some time ago and started advertising the fact that 100% of its food is 100% clean. So my question to Kim Richman, who is an attorney with Richman Law Group in New York City, who handles this kind of stuff, is, do consumers have the right to the reasonable expectation that Panera's food would be free of glyphosate? Do we have that right to expect that when they say they have 100% clean food?
Well, from our client's perspective, yes. And if they, of course, claim to be 100% clean, they should very well be 100% clean. Now, under many legal standards, when it comes to state consumer protection law, it's the reasonable consumer standard. And whether it be people's growing awareness around, first, say, GMOs in their food systems, it has ever since grown, and consciousness around our food is ever increasing, and people's expectations as a result do evolve. And we now have a far more, I think, informed population and a far more concerned population when it comes to what's indeed in our food. And so I would, posit that, yes, a reasonable consumer would expect that if a product claims to be 100% clean, that it would be free of a probable human carcinogen, which, you know, the World Health Organization deems glyphosate to be. While perhaps the EPA feels otherwise at this point in time, there is a growing concern, as we have seen, with regards to a lot of the litigation in California around non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and high exposures of glyphosate, or also known as Roundup.
So there seems to be a change with respect to how aware we are. If we're really dumb, or really naive, I should say, then maybe we don't have a reasonable expectation. But since we've become pretty clever about these things, we do have an expectation. Did I read that wrong?
No, that's true. And, in the past, when it came to trans fat, you can, perhaps turn around and read in the ingredients that it contains partially hydrogenated oils. Or over time, unfortunately, when it comes to, say, for instance, corn, wherein now 90% of our corn is genetically modified, you can pretty safely assume that if you see that in the ingredients, it may perhaps contain GMOs. But when it comes to contaminants such as glyphosate, there really is no disclosure on any of the products or menus. And so we have nothing but to rely upon then the representations made by the company, and in this case, 100% clean. And so labels do, in fact, matter. Representations to consumers do matter. And clearly, when they market it as such, and knowing that it resonates, right, based upon extensive market research, they should know that consumers are indeed relying upon such representations, and therefore do, in fact, have a right to know, have a right to rely upon it and to demand that if it's anything contrary, that they should be held responsible and they should be deemed to perhaps have engaged in false and deceptive advertising.
Well, yeah, one would think that. Moving on to the field of schemes, I guess that's what the feds call the Randy Constant fraud in a Missouri farmer. Largest organic fraud in U.S. history, $140 million worth of organic soybeans and corn that weren't really organic at all. And so all of, the 8% of the organic meats that people have spent extra money buying was really not what was, it was really in the meat. So how does such a giant organic fraud get away with it for so long, for a decade?
So unfortunately, there are increasing organic integrity issues. While we have USDA defining what is organic, from the process to the product, over the years, there perhaps have been growing issues. The national list of products that can perhaps be in organic foods that are not per se organic is growing, I think in part due to a lot of corporate pressure. And then with regards to enforcement of whether it's products coming into the country or perhaps certified by the QAIs of the world, the so-called third-party organic certifiers, there are indeed growing issues. I still believe in USDA organic. I think that it's probably some of the most robust legislation around our food systems that has proven to be very effective. Wherein, for instance, you know, the DARK Act, I think, does very little to bring greater transparency.
Well, it's just the opposite, you know. But it's designed to bring less transparency. But here we have a situation of an organic fraud, which to me means that whoever was certifying this organic operation of Randy Constant was either really missing something big or was getting paid not to see it.
Yeah, one can only speculate. But with regards to organic, again, I believe that it's the one corner of our food systems that is protected. I think that it may be overly protected, and so you see, unfortunately, attempts by industry to make statements such as all natural, 100% pure, in the case of Panera, 100% clean. As they know from research that people, in some cases, equate those types of food products with organic. In some cases, there have been some surveys showing that people think that natural or other similar statements is better than organic itself. And I think that the term natural is perhaps experiencing a lot of dilution and also is the subject of a lot of litigation. And so you see this evolution of statements, namely pure and most recently clean as being the new natural or in some respects being the new organic. And so I think that, you know, unfortunately, there is integrity issues across the board, whether it be organic or non-organic conventional products.
Mm-hmm. Earlier, you described yourself as kind of a private district attorney, in that you're chasing around all the bad guys who continually come up with new and clever ways to avoid you being captured. Is that kind of a good description of your efforts?
Yes. Typically, class action attorneys have been referred to as private attorney generals. I've always felt that the government can only do so much, and in some cases is broken, especially now more than ever. And that's where, you know, private rights of action are so integral to maintaining, you know, a clean and unadulterated food system. And so to that end, I think that you know, with regards to regulating, whether it be organic products or beyond, this is where, you know, it really does come down to folks like myself and clients of mine to really continue to police, you know, what is going on in the marketplace to maintain a level playing field, which, you know, not only consumers would appreciate, but I'm sure other well-meaning companies, organic companies or truly clean or natural pure companies would expect. And so it's, you know, a different, I think, regime that we find ourselves here in the United States versus, say, in the EU, where they operate by way of a precautionary principle and make sure that the systems are properly regulated and tested before it hits the market. Here, unfortunately, in the United States, to some extent, we are treated like guinea pigs, and a lot of food products hit the market that are not GMO-free or glyphosate-free, and it's only over time that we then, you know, have to, frankly, pick up the pieces, and that's indeed where we come in terms of trying to keep, frankly, an honest marketplace and a clean food system.
Well, I would like now to turn to how you go about doing this enforcement of our food chain, as it were. People come to you, nonprofit organization like GMO Free USA, and say, we have the situation that needs help. And you say what?
Well, as I described this trend under the Trump administration of more and more nonprofits taking up arms and bringing these matters to court. That's very much what has transpired here with regards to GMO for USA stepping up and having, for instance, diverted, you know, many resources to monitor the food systems, and have indeed issued this report where they've done extensive testing and rating of different restaurant establishments, and had hoped that the public education would carry the day, but have learned over time that it falls short in really changing corporate behavior. And so to that end, they brought suit along with the Clean Label Project in D.C. in hopes of, frankly, addressing the issue. We have, yes, indeed, a very active client base. And to that end, there are a lot of, you know, consumers who relied upon these statements. And we have also a pending consumer protection class action suit in California. And so hopefully, you know, between these two actions, we would see not only, you know, the defendant in question curb their behavior, but that it would hopefully send a message throughout the industry that you have to be straightforward with consumers. You have to make sure that you do, in fact, have control of your entire supply chain. Mm-hmm. And that's the one common denominator I see with a lot of the food litigation that we've done over the years, that there's a disconnect with regards to, you know, frankly, the farm and the table, and that, you know, they need to reach back and ask more questions, demand more from their suppliers, and ideally get back to the farm to be able to engage in a more, you know, transparent, more healthy approach to how everything is being sourced. And so the glyphosate in this case is not only the result of it being used as a weed killer or perhaps on, you know, Roundup Ready crops, but it's the fact that it's being now used as a desiccant. And so typically this would be sprayed upon oats and wheat in order to dry the crop quicker, mm-hmm. bring it to market to make sure you get 100% yield. And as a result of this pre-harvest spraying, you know, 7 to 10 days, it's inevitable that it's going to pop up in your actual food products. Fortunately, this ubiquitous use of glyphosate, of Roundup, in all these different forms, has not only tainted this one corner of our food systems, oats and wheat, but you know, other corners. We have seen it pop up in everything from orange juice to tea to honey. The list goes on.
To biodynamic wine. It's incredible. It's in the in everything.
Indeed, it is. And so.
So it's just
it's
incredible.
A little disturbing. Yeah.
So, okay, then so, the companies that sell bread, for example, you know, like Panera, are stuck with the fact that they're selling food that isn't clean, and it's going to be real difficult for them to find clean food to sell to customers.
So we did indeed see this type of defense or argument or what have you in the GMO context where, you know, folks have said, look, you know, 90% of corn in the U.S. is genetically modified. How are we ever going to find enough supply of corn that's GMO-free to meet the growing demand? And so sure enough, you know, there has been many GMO-free sources of corn. You have now the non-GMO Project Verified seal with the butterfly that you see on so many packages. And over time, you know, the market did evolve and found these glyphosate-free sources and realize that that is indeed something that resonates with consumers and is demanded and expected by consumers. And so we hope that over time, you know, the market will further respond when it comes to finding glyphosate-free sources of wheat and oats. And it does exist. It does exist. And there are great, certifications and organizations that are helping to facilitate that process. The Detox Project, for instance, headed up by Henry Rollins, does a great job in consulting multinational companies to find these glyphosate-free sources to track more aggressively their supply chain. There's other such certifications emerging, such as labelclean.org, is not only addressing glyphosate,
We're going to have to take a quick break, Kim, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you how you go about, take us through some of your cases. Teach us how you walk into somebody's office and say, if you want to say you're natural, you have to be natural. If you want to say clean, you have to be clean. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Kim Richmond and you right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yeah, but we do have some very interesting things to talk about, which is how Kim Richmond and the Richmond Law Group go after companies that are saying they're delivering one thing but delivering another. And what exactly do you do to stop them, to force them to sell you what they're really promising to sell you? Let's start with your efforts to working with an organization called Breathe DC. You went up against the Santa Fe Tobacco Company, which, of course, was the holder of the American Spirit tobacco brand, which claimed to be 100% addictive-free natural tobacco. Well, there's a mouthful.
Yeah, so I've talked a lot about how a lot of the work of nonprofits and consumers alike have brought greater transparency to our food systems. And we've referenced, for instance, the report GMO Free USA had done regarding glyphosate levels in restaurants. And it's an exciting time in terms of the science and how, in fact, not only can we put companies under a figurative microscope, but literally put them under a microscope and test products. And so there are a growing number of labs, independent labs, that are indeed through mass spec and otherwise detecting levels of glyphosate and the like. And so with regards to this science powering these lawsuits, it's just been incredible wherein we can indeed peer into these products, whether they are listed on the ingredient list or otherwise, see what is really within the product, despite, unfortunately, in some cases, claims to the contrary. And so that has been, I think, in large measure, a game changer in the last couple of decades with a lot of the food litigation you've seen proliferated, wherein you can detect everything from, yes, glyphosate, GMOs, to trans fat with a fairly straightforward scientific test. And so with these lab results, they indeed, in some respects, act as Exhibit A to a lot of the complaints that are filed in state and federal court. And it is a smoking gun in some cases. And I think to the surprise sometimes of the defendant, who may not have otherwise had the quality control in place, even though their marketing department has gotten, you know, far ahead of itself with regards to claims of natural or pure or clean.
Sure. It's easy to say it's natural because it is natural, because what is natural is kind of a hard thing to define, I guess. But take us to, you conducted a campaign against the Santa Fe Tobacco Company and the American Spirit, which I always thought was a fascinating idea. I'm not a cigarette smoker, but I noticed the packages of American Spirit tobacco and see that it says it's natural and it's 100% addictive-free. And an organization called Breathe DC evidently went to you folks, and you guys took on this case. And since it's already adjudicated, how did you go? What happened when you walked in the door of the Santa Fe Tobacco Company and said, well, you're not really 100% addictive free and you're not really natural, so let's talk?
Well, a lot of the litigation was a result of the FDA, believe it or not, issuing a warning letter stating that it was perhaps not a healthier or safer cigarette than, say, Marlboro or Camel. And so in the wake of the FDA issuing this warning letter, there was indeed a lot of litigation. And so, but unfortunately, the FDA went only so far, and that's where a lot of the consumer watchdog and consumer protection class action suits continue in terms of trying to, frankly, address you know, consumers and the general public. And so with regards to Breathe DC, they are a small but mighty tobacco control group based in DC. There are other affiliates across the country. You have, for instance, you know, Breathe California, et cetera. And it's, you know, been obviously frustrating for a lot of these tobacco control groups in terms of regulating big tobacco. And now more recently, of course, e-cigarettes. And so right. Similarly, you see now a lot of litigation, for instance, with this e-cigarette company, Juul. And only just recently, despite the emerging science and litigation, the FDA issued a warning letter. And so a little late, however, still nonetheless important for, you know, ideally both the litigation and the legislation to go hand in hand in terms of really this growing public health issue, whether it be with regards to traditional tobacco or now, of course, this epidemic with regards to e-cigarettes.
You know, what you, so, what, yeah. What you brought up with respect to it being difficult for consumer groups to deal with the government, you know, that really, I think, goes to the heart of the issue, because government is really subject to the tremendous amount of money that can be brought to bear by industry to lobby for this or that. You know, a tobacco company can go to Washington, D.C. and pour a lot of money into the political hopper, and so then government becomes reluctant to you know, enforce some discipline when it's getting so much money not to. And so that what choice is there other than to fight in the courts? Is there another course of action?
No, surely special interests are very much at play. And you see this, you know, in the glyphosate context being played out as we speak, wherein, you know, the EPA, for instance, has been reluctant to deem it a probable human carcinogen, as the World Health Organization and IARC has done so in the last, you know, now 2-3 years. There have been, of course, some very interesting documents that have come to light. Carrie Gillum has written a very interesting book to that extent, the Monsanto Papers, wherein you see this very cozy relationship between Monsanto and the EPA. And, you know, with regards to the tolerance levels, right, with regards to certain food products such as oats and wheat, the EPA does set certain tolerance levels. And you've seen those levels, surprisingly or maybe not surprisingly, keep getting higher and higher. And so it does not really, frankly, address our public health. I think that it's wherein, yes, these companies need to be kept in check by whether it be consumers or nonprofits. And so, yes. And so it's special interest.
How do you fight that money other than going to court? I don't see any other means of doing it.
Yeah, this is, you know.
I mean, you could stand on a street perhaps, corner and yell and scream and holler, but that's not going to do any good. You have to figure out some way of fighting for your right to know.
No. Yeah, it's true. Unfortunately, you know, fortunately, our system you know, has a balance of power, and the judiciary does seem to be, you know, our best hope these days when the executive branch and legislative branch are unfortunately not doing much other than for advancing corporate interests. And so with regards to, you know, taking these issues to the court, it's proven to be very powerful and successful, particularly in D.C. as of late, for these nonprofit groups to step forward who indeed have standing, statutory standing, you know, in light of the amendments to their consumer protection statute, unlike anywhere else in the country where otherwise they would have to show a diversion of resources and clear other hurdles in order to step forward as a plaintiff in a lawsuit. But, you know, with regards to, you know, these nonprofits and the work that consumers have been doing, it is, again, a multifaceted advocacy approach that is so key. And so, you know, it's not only just the lawsuit itself, it is indeed all the advocacy work, public education, social media campaigns, marching all that together that hopefully does move the needle in the right direction.
And it would appear to be, too, when it gets right down to it, because, you know, like we learned earlier in the show, that one of the top three consumer demands is for clean food. We want the clean food, and that's
indeed
top of our list. Take us to another case here, a fascinating one, Organic Consumers Union versus Nature Valley. I love the names these companies adopt. They seem so nice. Nature Valley. What could be bad about that? Another one, Handsome Brook Farms. So these are both pretty big operations, and Nature Valley, of course, was whole grain oats made with 100% natural whole grain oats. So what was interesting about this case is that you did not have to litigate. So how did you get an agreement?
You're referring to the Nature Valley granola bar case.
Yeah.
Nature Valley is owned by General Mills, and many folks are, of course, familiar with this product, this over-the-counter product. And as I was outlining earlier, you know, when it comes to oats and wheat, unfortunately, there is widespread use of glyphosate as a desiccant. And so, you know, it has unfortunately been revealed by multiple reports, et cetera, whether it be by the Environmental Working Group or other organizations, of glyphosate popping up in breakfast cereals and beyond. We have, you know, unfortunately, yes, seen this proliferation beyond over-the-counter products such as Nature Valley granola bars and in fast casual restaurants, as we talked about as well. And that's an interesting trend that we have not typically have seen. A lot of the food litigation as of the last decade has been largely focused on over-the-counter products. The fact that, you know, now restaurants are engaging in some of the same type of alleged false and deceptive advertising, and that the food products are equally testing positive, it's a disturbing trend. And that's where in some of the later cases that we have been bringing are of real interest. And so Panera being the latest. So with regards to, you know, companies like you referenced, Hanson Brook Farms, that was a matter involving, you know, pasture-raised eggs, and wherein there were questions as to whether or not they were truly pasture-raised. It's been interesting in that that was originally, yes, brought by the Organic Consumers Association in D.C., but was then, subsequent to that, we got retained by a truly pasture-raised company, Vital Farms, and we had brought a Lanham Act case, which is similar to the false and deceptive advertising issues we discussed brought by consumers and nonprofits against companies. But this is wherein a business brings an action against another business. And so what we have seen are not only perhaps consumers who have this growing consciousness and expectation around their food, mission-driven nonprofits, but also progressive businesses.
So here you have a business, your client was a business that was actually raising pastured chickens and eggs. It was actually going to the trouble of doing it right and seeing their neighbor not doing it right and making the claim. And so they came to you and you took them to court.
That's correct. And as we talked about earlier, you know, a level playing field is important, of course, not only to consumers and nonprofits, but to other businesses that are indeed doing it right, not cutting corners, that are, you know, expending the resources in order to give a better quality, cleaner, truly natural product, superior product, a premium product that folks are indeed willing to pay for. And when you have companies that perhaps, yes, cut corners, it does ruin it for other businesses. And you do, in fact, see this explosion of a really, you know, progressive businesses and for that matter, trade associations stepping forward as you see just how evolved our eating habits have become, you know, in the very recent past, plant-based, et cetera. So I think there is an interesting trend here that is exciting, but is also unfortunately being, you know, adulterated and co-opted and sometimes, used to, frankly, you know, capitalize on this growing expectation of consumers.
Well, Kim Richmond, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you folks at the Richmond Law Group for all you do to, you know, enforce some discipline on our food chain. You know, because if we spend so much more for the foods we want, and we just really would like it to be what it's promised to be. Kim Richmond, thank you so much. Folks, remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain.
Thank you, Michael.
The farther you go from the source of your food, less control you have over what's in your food. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.